out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 10th of July 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Well, it's Wednesday today, which means we have historical revisionist Carolyn Yeager with us today from carolynyeager.net. Morning, Carolyn. How are you doing today?
Well, good morning, Sven. I'm doing well.
Excellent, excellent. And we've got a particularly interesting subject this week to discuss, the war on populism, because it is a war that's being waged against us, a really dirty war. I've been a victim just recently of smears and slander in the press about Radio Aryan saying that we want to exterminate all the Jews or words to that effect, which aren't true. I mean, it is a dirty war that's being waged against us. Which particular parts of it did you want to concentrate on today?
Well, I think I'll start with the news story about the AFD candidates for parliament being disallowed from the in the upcoming Saxony election. You know, we mentioned that these three eastern states in Germany are being having their state parliament elections in September. And this is a big deal because they're very strong. AFD is very strong there. First and second place in most polling. They're expected to do very well there. And now one of these states, Saxony, what happened was that as it says here, German elections are a complicated mix of the first past the post system used in the UK and proportional representation. I don't really fully understand, but I know that I guess first past the post system in the UK is just like whoever gets the most votes, huh? I mean, you don't have to have a majority. Yeah, you just have to have more than everybody else. Is that what that means?
Yeah, that's the first past the post.
Maybe more, but
that's it. That's first past the post. I mean, there's lots of calls to have proportional representation, but they won't have it. And because it's first past the post, it means it's always just Conservative or Labour, and nobody else gets a look in. I don't think it's a very good system like that, to be honest.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, that's more similar to what we have in the U.S., which we're also used to. You know, we're used to two parties, and we don't really like the idea of thinking that we'd have a representation from a bunch of them. And then it's harder to get things done, or you have to, you know, ally with this group and that group and do all this stuff. But anyway, this is what happened here was that you vote. But I understand in Germany, you vote for a list, the party list. You vote for the party, and the party has put forth a list of their candidates. And then there's also something called direct candidates who are like standing on their own. They might be a part of that party, or they might favor that party, but they can do whatever they want, so to speak, once they get elected. And they have both of these. AFD has both of these kinds of people, but their party list, they picked in two different sessions in the same place, the same town. They had a party congress and they picked 18 of them, and they didn't have enough all lined up at that time. So very shortly afterwards, they got all that taken care of, and they held a second party Congress, and they picked the rest of them that they would need to fill all the seats that they think they might win. And what happened then was that the establishment in the state of Saxony, which is anti-AFD, of course, you know, anti-populist, said, oh, no, you can't do that. You can only have the candidates that you elected in the first Congress. You can't have groups from two different Congresses. And so they've argued about that, but the establishment wins. And even though they're going to appeal it, they can only appeal it after the election. So they're kind of stuck there. And they've got some other, you know, possibilities that it might turn, you know, they can have more direct candidates and so on, but directly elected. But it's a, you know, it's like one of these things where that they, this is just one element, one type, one, what would you call it? Example, one example of the war on populism and the, and what these, what a party like the AfD in Germany has to put up with, because all the others join together against them and vote together against them. So it makes it difficult. And so they're dealing with that now. And that brought up, you know, more discussion about populism. And, you know, the definition of populism that I found that seems pretty good is, it's a political philosophy supporting the rights and power of the people in their struggle against the privileged elite. That is, you know, that there is such a thing as a privileged elite, and it wants to pretend like it's democracy, but it forces its own way. And we know that this has taken place in the EU and in most government, most states in Europe. And of course, in the U.S., Donald Trump's called a populist, and in the U.S. we call it the swamp. You know, the group in the Capitol that is, they say, the permanent government that never goes away. That even though different governments are elected, they come and go. There's this permanent group that holds things to a certain what I would call the rules-based United Nations New World Order type thing, and that covers Europe and the United States. So it's actually post World War II order that they've established and don't want to change. So this is so the question is, democracy. See, they want to say populism is anti-democratic. And, you know, the other, on the other side, you can say that it's only true democracy, and that, the anti-populism is to not allow real democracy and to have this privileged elite, continue to run things the way they want to for their own interests, which we generally see as globalism or world corporatism and various things like that. But in any case, I came upon this interview with Timothy Snyder. And I don't know if you know who Timothy Snyder is, but he's a history professor from Yale University. I learned about him a long time ago when his book, The Bloodlands, came out. It was a big, big success. Well, they probably made it a success. And he's been a big, big deal ever since. And he's written a lot of other books. And he's basically a Holocaust historiographer, although on a more, you know, expanded level, I guess. Now this guy's also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and on the Committee on Conscience of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So that gives you an idea of what he stands for. And he's also married to another history professor who sounds like she's probably Polish and maybe Jewish, and her book is Caviar and Ashes, A Warsaw Generation's Life and Death in Marxism, 1918 and 1958. So, you know, it's a biography of Polish and Polish Jewish writers drawn to Marxism in the 20th century. And she also is the translator of Michael Glowinski's Holocaust memoir, The Black Seasons. So you see, you know, that where these, where he and he's just totally, immersed in the post-Holocaust order and committed to it and so on. So now they're asking him about, populism. And the first question was, is liberal democracy a thing of the past? And his weird answer was that, the big problem and the big challenge for today is that we're all living in a permanent now in which the future is conceived as an extension of the present. And in a permanent now, democracy doesn't make any sense because democracy is about looking at the past to make decisions in the present, which will affect the future. Well, now, first, I never thought of democracy as being defined that way. I don't know. That's not, it doesn't have nothing to do with democracy, but anyway, that's what he's saying. And so we have to keep people in a world where time flows forward, he says, so we can have democracy. Well, you know, that's about as enlightening. I don't know. Did you make any sense out of that, Sven?
Well, I always thought democracy was about putting things to the vote, basically, so that the majority wins, which is a bit like mob rule, really, because the people that are least qualified to actually make decisions are the majority, because it's always only a tiny amount of people who actually have qualifications, who are highly intelligent, that follow politics, that are really qualified to make these decisions. So I see that there are flaws to democracy, but that's what it essentially is. It's a head count, isn't it? It's the most number of people that vote for something. They win. They are the majority. And I always thought, well, and that also means that's popular. Whatever they decide on is popular. But I think that description of populism that you gave there is, you know, that's a very good description of it. Basically wanting to take down these elites because they're false elites. I think that's the issue. They're false elites.
Well, but it's the elites. Money. But if it gets a little tricky because if you say, we don't want the mob voting because they're not smart enough and they don't know enough, then you end up with a policy of elitism, and the elites are the one. Then who's going to be the elite? So then you know you can't keep that the way it should be. And in a lot of cases, when we have democracy, a lot of people don't vote. The people who are not qualified to vote, unless they're really stirred up and forced and dragged to the polls by the liberal or the extreme parties that want them to go there, and pay them even to vote. And, then they do, but otherwise, people won't, and usually it's people who have an interest and follow it who do the voting. So it works out pretty well. In any case, we'll set that aside for now and go on in this interview. So the next question they asked him was, should we stop using the term populism because it means too many different things? He says... Now listen to this. He says, people we call populists have these things in common. They deny climate change. Now, that's funny. That's the first thing. And that populist, he says, all populists. He's really confusing the people he doesn't agree with, the people who are against these things that they're trying to, that the global order is trying to push through. And with populism, which isn't the way to do it, but anyway, that's actually what they're doing. And number two, they use digital means, which I think he means social media. He can't just say social media as say digital means more than their opponents do. And foreign countries often carry out digital campaigns on their behalf. Well, this is not typical of populism. This is just that today they say that those they call populists are friends with, say, Russia in a lot of cases, and that they think that the Russia and Putin are helping their campaigns and running social media, interfering with social media in their countries and so on. That's probably true, but that hasn't connected with populism per se. And then three, he says populists deny factuality and question the idea there's a real world or that facts matter. Now, this is the Hillary Clinton baloney, you know, that her opponents don't follow the facts, that she follows the facts, and they all talk like that now, that they're on the side of the facts when it's just the opposite. You know, we think the opposite. People who are supporting the so-called populists, it's the establishment that denies the facts. So it's a question of you can't. You know, we gets into that a little bit later, but, you know, how do you determine what are the facts? But everybody's, both sides are claiming that they have the facts. So, that's a big deal in Holocaust historiography, because as we know, you know, they say they have all the facts, and the revisionists have shown that the facts are different from what they say, and they don't have the facts. So there's no easy solution to that. It's an argument that goes on. And if you don't really respect facts, which they don't, then you can't come to a conclusion on it. So now then he adds that populists don't have a meaningful relationship to the people. Now, that's exactly what populism is. But no, they turn it around and say, no, they don't. And they represent foreign oligarchical interests or American or Russian energy companies, he says. Can you believe? The biggest oligarch operating today is like George Soros. You know, this idea about energy companies, that they're always trying to blame everything on energy companies rather than shadow governments or the real behind-the-scenes establishment that is supporting things for the global order. It's opposite.
It's a total reversal,
you know?
Isn't it? It's a total reversal of the way that things really are. And I mean, to say that populism isn't popular with the people, it's funded by oligarchs, that's nonsense. You know, we're trying to take down the oligarchs. I mean, I would say with that elitism thing that the elites we have today, they're false elites. They're there through usury, and they shouldn't be at the top. The real elites should be the ones, the scientists, the people that really are genuine experts. Because when they're talking about facts there, when this Snyder guy is talking about facts, he doesn't actually mean facts. He means what the newspapers report. As we know, the facts and the statistics are completely different to what the newspapers report. And the actual scientists that do this research, a lot of the time, they're actually blanked out, and their papers are refused because the university is worried that the left are going to attack them if they actually publish the paper. So the facts and the statistics, the real facts, are kept out of it. And the false facts, the fake news, which is produced by the newspapers, that's put forward as being factual. So that's the difference there. This Snyder guy, he believes what the mainstream media tells him. He probably knows it's actually false, but that's the idea that he promotes. Whereas the populists go on what the facts are. They go on the crime figures that are linked with the immigration figures, mainly.
Yeah, that's how I see it too. So they're turning it around. It's like they don't have the good argument. The populists have the good argument. The elites don't have the good argument, or those who are in control and have been in control for quite a while now, and maybe forever really. But anyway, they kind of change their spots and adjust to the new times. But they don't have the argument, so they are turning it around and pretending like our argument is theirs and theirs is ours. So it's tricky. And people, of course, I don't know how many people would listen to him, but this is generally what's put out all the time, everywhere, you know, and even on just the newspaper level. So you have to be aware of how they do this, because otherwise you just get caught up and you just gets, you feel like you can't, you don't know how to respond to it. So now he has one more thing here that about populism. He says another thing that describes populists is that they don't have any idea about the future. This is relates to what he started saying. He said they try to keep us in a permanent now of us and them, and so it's the populists who are creating the us and them rather than the far left that's creating us and them. And then kind of cyclical politics. I know he says. Then he says I don't think populism is the best name. Well, see what he's describing isn't populism. So naturally he says, well, I don't think that's the best name. We should change. We should call it something else so it can be what we're saying it is and why it's not good.
What's he going to call anyway, it? Fascism. Fascism, I bet. I bet that's the name that he'd like to come up for it. I mean, we are the ones that actually think about the future. I mean, that's why populists do what they do, is because we want a better country for our children, and because we're thinking about what's going to happen in the future with all these foreigners mm-hmm. here and what it's going to be like for, you know, for the next generation. And we're the ones that are actually thinking about that. And it's, you know, it's the left that don't seem to have any concern at all about what the country's going to look like in 10 years' time. They just want to keep importing foreigners in. They want to destroy the country.
Well, they want it to look very different. They're destroying just exactly the way the Bolsheviks in Russia, as it became the Soviet Union, took over Russia, exactly the same way they want to destroy. And the same thing they did in Germany at the end of World War One. They just threw out the Kaiser and threw out the monarchy and changed. They wanted to make it turn into a Soviet state. And they had little success here and there for a while. But the army fought them off. You know, the army was not under their control, really. So they this is what they do. They want to take away whatever we think of, whatever we've earned freedom, which because they're trying to portray populism as what the word you used in the beginning, mob rule, and just gonna, you know, be take away all your rights and so on, individual rights, blah blah. Yeah, take away the rights for foreigners. That's about it. So anyway, then she asks him, how can we strive for truth in an increasingly complex world? Well, he gives some, he says you have to take an ethical position that truth is worth striving for. Ah, well, they're not doing that. And then second, he said there has to be public policy subsidized, and then he says examples of public policy to support fact creators. Okay, public policy to support facts. How do you do that? He says maybe subsidizing public radio or public television, or creating the equivalent of public internet. Think about that. Or subsidizing investigative journalism. Who's investigated journalism? You know, the established journals, investigative journalism, or messing around with the algorithms to bring the facts to the fore. So what you brought up of the social media earlier, well, maybe that was just to me personally, that going on with all that concern everybody's aware of, that they set these algorithms as to what will come to the fore on search engines on the internet. And let me tell you, I really notice just in the last year, and I don't know how long it's been creeping up, but that I can't find anything that I used to find searched for something. When I first got on the internet, it was wonderful. I searched for things and I'd come up with all kinds of interesting and good articles and yeah, I guess you'd say pages and so on, that were both on both sides, but now it's all on one side. And you go down the entire page of items, and there's they're all on the left, or, you know, and they're everything. And then I go on and on. Eventually, I usually can find something that isn't, but it's getting very bad, and I'm starting to be discouraged or losing interest.
It's
in
like
the internet
words.
Because the stuff is hidden away, and they really have succeeded in doing away with it.
It's like taking words out of the dictionary. You know, you're looking for a word in the dictionary. Oh, it's gone. It's not there anymore. And it's like that when you're using a search engine now, and you're looking up information on certain subjects or certain events, and there's just nothing there. And you keep going through the pages, and you used to get lots of information there. And what they've done there is they've taken the democracy out of the internet, because those algorithms, they used to be purely democratic. The most popular stories would rise to the top, so it was entirely democratic. And that's what they've done, is they've done away with the democracy of the internet by tinkering with the algorithms so that it only puts forward the content that they want people to see. I mean, it's disgusting that they've done this, and I do hope Donald Trump does something about it. What you're referring to there is his social media summit, where he's got Ben Garrison, the cartoonist, and somebody else from Project Veritas that's going to be there. I do hope he has somebody there like Alex Jones as well. The left are furious about this, but he needs to be told what's going on, and hopefully these guys will actually tell him what's going on, and that these conservative voices are being censored. These algorithms are removing news stories which should be there, news stories which get broken on YouTube, like the Project Veritas one about Google. That's all being censored and removed, and because he can do something about it. The president can do something about it, and he needs to do something about it, because, you know, it's dangerous for all of us, particularly for free speech. I mean, America is, you know, that's the beacon of free speech in the world. If it goes there, you know, we what else are we going to do? So we really do need him to do something about it.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very serious. And this business about what's on, about censoring information is probably the most important of all. So then she asked, should we have laws against trolls, hate speech, and fake news, especially on the internet? And so then he goes on, you know,
who's going to decide that, though? Who's going to decide who is a troll, who is the fake news, and who is the hate speech? This is the thing. They say, you need to ban, you know, these governments go to these companies, and they say, well, you need to take all that hate speech off there. And they say, well, can you give us a definition of what this hate speech is then? And they'll say, well, you know what hate speech is. It's anti-Semitism and it's racism. And then these companies, they think, well, we've got to be very careful. We don't get sued here for lots of money. We don't get fined. Especially in Germany, they've told these companies, you're going to be fined thousands and thousands of euros if there's anything on there we don't like. And then they're extra careful, and they just remove anything. Do you know what I mean? They're extra careful that they're not going to get caught. So anything that might be racism, might not be racism, they're just going to remove it anyway, because otherwise they're going to get fined. And they're basically saying, instead of looking at the law to see whether something is illegal, we'll just give you that power.
He makes a good point here, though. I mean, it's an interesting point, because it's about anonymity. And Snyder says that free speech is based on the principle that you know who's speaking. And he mentions the Austrians, who are saying that, I guess some of them are saying that people who represent themselves on the internet should be able to identify themselves, or maybe should have to identify themselves. And Austria has proposed banning anonymous online comments to fight hate speech. That's kind of dangerous. But, you know, I agree that there's so much lack of identity now. And, you know, when you go on the internet and you're totally anonymous and saying a lot of things, it's like you know, the people, the Antifa, who go around putting masks on their faces, or others, whatever group is putting masks and then going out and committing crimes. I don't think, you know, you can't make that an exact comparison or parallel, but I don't know what the answer to it is, but you have to let people speak. If you have free speech, and you're not going to destroy people, because the whole problem is this whole category of hate speech should never have been allowed. So you can't have free speech and hate speech at the same time. And this is where the problem is. But see, this is another example, Sven, where we allow this stuff to creep in, like hate speech. Okay, well, nobody likes hate. So, all right, I would never, ever have voted, you know, to allow hate speech to be considered anything, you know, a category of crime or something. But and hate laws, I mean, hate crimes, but they did. It did get, and now it's creating all kinds of problems, which you almost can't solve, because you can't have free speech and hate speech. That's the beginning of the end of free speech.
It is,
and
it
that's.
Is.
You know, that's about where I'll end up here.
Well, I noticed the other day, actually, there's actually a clause in the Public Order Act, in the British Public Order Act, which says none of this can be used to prevent people from, was it mocking? It doesn't actually say hating, but it says a word that actually means hating, mocking, criticizing, saying whatever you like about religions. It doesn't actually have a clause about race, but it does about religions, which means that you can mock and ridicule Judaism, Islam. You can point all these things out. And this clause just very rarely actually gets mentioned, but I'm sure there must be, well, there is. I mean, you've got your First Amendment or whatever it is that says it guarantees that you've got free speech over there in America, but that doesn't apply with these private companies, you see, because they're private companies. Something's got to be done about it anyway. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Carolyn. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.